Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, on Indigenous Peoples Day, more than 200 people were arrested. 200 people protested at two sites to stop construction of the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline. 27 people were arrested. The action happened just one day after the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia rejected the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's request for an injunction to halt construction of the pipeline by Texas-based Energy Transfer Partners. In a two-page ruling, the U.S. court rejected the request for an injunction, and the tribe now says that the next couple of weeks are critical. The tribe called the ruling disappointing, but says that it does not plan to rest until its lands, people, water, and sacred places are protected from this pipeline. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's struggle to stop the pipeline has garnered global support. Native Americans from over 300 tribal nations have traveled to the Sacred Stone Camp, which is just outside of Bismarck, North Dakota, about a 45-minute drive, to support the tribe's struggle against construction of the pipeline. This struggle is also about tribal sovereignty, the right to live on the land, and finding solutions to our environmental crisis. On today's Your Call, we are spending the hour talking about the ramifications of the rulings, the increasing presence of armed police forces at the site of the protests, and the future of the movement. Today, we're joined by Candy Mossett, a Native Energy and Climate Campaign organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network in North Dakota. Candy has been at the camp on a regular basis and joins us from a hotel nearby. Hi, Candy. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you for having me today.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Stephanie Sosi, an associate attorney with Earth Justice and a co-counsel representing the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in its lawsuit against the Army Corps of Engineers over the Dakota Access Pipeline. Hi, Stephanie. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So, Candy, thanks so much for taking some time away from the camp to join us. I just got back last night. I was there for about 4 days interviewing people. And I have to say, it was really great to be on site, to see the land, to see the Missouri River, because it gave me so much context. Reading about it, seeing the videos are one thing, but actually seeing the land is something completely different. It just gives you a different perspective. Before we dive in and talk about the legalities and the arrests, can you just give us an overview of where we are now? Because you told me something that I didn't really get from the articles, and that is, right now, the most crucial part of the fight is basically 20 miles of pipeline. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So first of all, for everybody that's listening out there, I'd like to introduce myself in my Hidatsa language. So Dosha Maragua Marashima A Ishuvia Het. And I said, hello, relatives. My name is Eagle Woman. My English name is Candy Mossett. I am Mandan Hidatsa Rikara from just northwest of where the Standing Rock Reservation is located. I grew up in a reservation called Fort Berthold in a little tiny town called Newtown, which is in the heart of the Bakken Formation. And the Bakken Formation is where this oil is being extracted and dug up and where it's coming from and proposed to go through the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so the starting point is actually near Tioga, North Dakota, up near where I live and where my family is. And then, of course, as you know, the pipeline goes down from North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, Illinois, and then off to refineries in the Gulf Coast. And so I think that we've been saying many times, I've been saying that this fight is about so much more than just one pipeline. It's the big picture of what the fossil fuel industry is and has been doing to Native Americans ever since Christopher Columbus got lost and we discovered him. And so yesterday was a huge day in that we're reclaiming Indigenous Peoples Day, yesterday, October 10th. And it was just pretty ironic that the what happened was the judge in the court there. I have to back up a little bit. So there was an appeal date on October 5th. And on October 5th, there wasn't any decision that was made to uphold the injunction or to not uphold the injunction. The stuff that we had heard was that they would need maybe months to make a decision. And for us on the ground, we thought that was a victory because that meant that the injunction would be upheld. Now, the tribe's injunction is a temporary injunction, and the request was to protect and not allow work on 20 miles to the east of the Missouri River or 20 miles to the west of the Missouri River. And so when there was no decision on Wednesday, October 5th, I thought, okay, that's a good thing. At least the 20-mile buffer will still be protected. But then just 4 days later, on Sunday, October 9th, the three-panel judge did come with a decision saying that they would not uphold the injunction, that the injunction was denied. So again, we were on an emotional roller coaster. We didn't really know what to expect other than we had to protect that 20-mile buffer zone. And so yesterday, October 10th, Indigenous Peoples Day, we went to Highway 6, which is where the 20-mile area is, and in prayer and ceremony, and erected a teepee. And as a result, we were targeted again by the police, the militarization, I have heard that it's 29 people from our legal team that actually were arrested yesterday. Two of them are facing felony charges. And so we were all just kind of really busy yesterday. We also had a children's powwow yesterday in Bismarck, a little mini powwow. And so then there was some confusion, but I had heard that there was another decision made. Another joint statement did come out from the Department of Justice, the Department of the Army, and the Department of the Interior regarding the BC Circuit Court of Appeals decision that was made in Standing Rock Sioux Tribe versus Army Corps of Engineers. And so they came out with another statement, talking about how they are requesting that the pipeline company voluntarily pause all construction activity within 20 miles east or west of Lake Oahe. Again, I don't know how much teeth that statement actually has, because it's a voluntary pause that the Dakota Access Company isn't required or mandated to stop within that 20-mile work zone. The other thing people should be aware of is that here in North Dakota, drone usage is a legal thing. And so even though police have been using them, we've been using them as well. And even when the Dakota Access Pipeline was under I don't know what the exact wording is, but when they had to stop working within the 20 miles, when it was not just voluntary, but they were told that they had to, they were still working 4 miles in to that 20-mile range. We discovered this through our drone footage. And so they were already breaking the law, and yet nothing is being done there. Well, I'm not sure if nothing is being done. I know our legal team is building a case, and maybe Stephanie can talk more about that.
And before we do that, Candy, so again, this is a 1,168-mile pipeline. And is it accurate to say that 60% of the pipeline has already been completed, mostly in South Dakota and Iowa?
Yes, that's what I've been hearing. That's what the company itself, the Energy Transfer Partners, has released. And they're basically saying, look, 60% is already built. What's this all about? They're trying to bully their way as an oil company to put as much in the ground as quickly as they can, regardless of us as Native Americans on the ground here saying that they did not properly consult with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, that they did not take into account the sacred and cultural sites. There are approximately 380 sites in this corridor of significant cultural importance. And one site has already been destroyed. And it's crazy that the state historic preservation officers have come up with an impartial report that said, well, we're not sure that a sacred site was destroyed. Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, the tribal historic preservation officers, those of us that know, are saying we are 100% certain. We know that effigies were destroyed and that burial sites were disturbed. There's no question about that. And so it's the nationwide permit 12 is what Dakota Access Energy Transfer Partners used to start this pipeline project. So instead of looking at it as an over 1,100-mile pipeline, they broke it down into little sections, little pieces within each state. And so it, going by section and by piece, is how they got away with not doing a full-on environmental impact statement for the entire length of the pipeline. So each little piece, they said, oh, you know, we did an environmental assessment, an EA, which in many cases is a 1 or 2 page assessment done by the company itself, and then they come up with a FONSI, which is a finding of no significant impact for each little piece of the project. If they had looked at this project in its entirety and done a full environmental impact statement, we wouldn't even be here where we are right now, because they would have found the cultural sites, they would have found the burial sites, and the company knew that. So the whole time they've been bullying their way to get as much in the ground as they can before they can be stopped, like we did with Keystone XL.
And the tribe submitted documents to the court showing that the pipeline passes through and is destroying native burial and will destroy native burial sites and sacred places. Right? These
That's
are documents.
Right. That's right. What happened was, I don't have the exact date right here in front of me, but the Friday before the sacred site was dug up, we had submitted, Standing Rock Sioux Tribe had submitted documents to the courts showing that there were sacred sites. They gave the GPS coordinates. They wanted to order a cease and desist. It was Labor Day weekend when all of this happened. And we had to order a cease and desist in order to be able to work with the state historic preservation officers, who would then have to come down. And then they would have to verify the sacred site. But before any of that could be done, Dakota Access, Energy Transfer Partners leapfrogged over a 15-mile tract of land where they had been working. They skipped ahead 15 miles, went exactly to those GPS coordinates, and dug a 2.2-mile swath, knowingly and intentionally destroying Arikara burial sites. Two, maybe three graves were disturbed. And when I talked to the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, he says, you know, there were beautiful effigies and rock cairns out there. There was the Big Dipper, the Little Dipper, there was a bear, there was red rocks that were all placed in these formations. And they were there Friday, and on Saturday they were gone.
Mm.
And so it was just like, oh my God, this company is so evil that they knowingly did this. And now they're saying, hey, the injunction was denied. We don't really care. We never did care. Get out of our way so we can continue to attack this last 20 miles.
Stephanie, can you jump in here? Stephanie Sosi is an associate attorney with Earth Justice. Specifically on this issue, can you talk about the legalities around this? What happens when the tribe submits documents to the court certifying this claim that the pipeline will pass through and destroy native burial sites and sacred places?
Well, you know, that was a really tragic day, and we were in court the very next week seeking a temporary restraining order on that very specific action, and we did get a temporary restraining order. Unfortunately, there's a bit of a different story that Dakota Access is telling and that the Corps is telling in terms of jurisdiction. So, you know, it's a tragic thing that happened, and we're certainly fighting it right now in the court. But if you ask somebody from Dakota Access or from the Corps, they would tell you that they have no authority to stop in those areas.
We're going to talk more about the decision, but I want to get one more fact out there that's really important. According to the tribe, the Missouri River provides drinking water to 18 million people. The original pipeline was supposed to cross the Missouri River just north of Bismarck, which is the capital of North Dakota. But after people expressed concern for the city's water supply, the route was shifted downstream to the tribe's doorstep. And Stephanie, when I was there, I tried to get answers to this. Who made this decision to reroute the pipeline from north of Bismarck? Again, that's North Dakota's capital. This is about 45 miles. It's about a 45-minute drive from the main camp. Who made the decision to reroute the pipeline to the tribe's doorstep?
So there were a number of proposed routes, you know, when we're looking at the whole almost 1,200-mile pipeline, they had a number of proposed routes and alternate routes. And the route north of Bismarck was a proposed route that they looked at. Ultimately, the Corps and Dakota Access made the decision to route it south of Bismarck. But we don't know exactly why. They list a few reasons in their final environmental assessment, but you know, it's hard to pinpoint exactly why just from that document.
And the Bismarck City Council, did they have anything to do with it?
I don't know. I can't speak to that.
Okay. Candy, do you know?
Well, what I know is that our governor, Jack Dalrymple, has been downplaying the concerns about the Dakota Access Pipeline. But I do know that and I'm trying to find it right now. There's a point where he had said that they did not want it north of Bismarck. There was a point where he had said that in an interview, and there was a quote in a press release that had come out a long time ago. I can't find it right now, but at some point he was being interviewed, and they didn't want it north of Bismarck. But then in a later interview, I think it was with KFGO News, he was talking about the risk to the environment because we had such a big uprising here. And he was saying, quote, this is a state-of-the-art pipeline, a very sophisticated project. It is not in any way unsafe except for a very, very, very minimal risk.
Hmm.
So just totally downplaying it. But before, when it was north of Bismarck, he was saying that it was a risk to the drinking water supplies of the citizens of Bismarck.
Wow. I mean, I think that's such an important piece of this story here, that the pipeline was supposed to cross the Missouri River just north of Bismarck. And we should say 80 to 90% white. This is the capital of North Dakota, but after concerns for the water supply, the route was shifted downstream to the tribe's doorstep, and the Missouri River provides drinking water for 18 million people. Today, we are talking about what's happening with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's request for an injunction to halt construction of the pipeline. On Sunday, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia rejected that request. The next couple of weeks are going to be critical. In fact, yesterday on Indigenous Peoples Day, more than 200 people protested at two sites to stop construction. 27 people were arrested. And we're getting the latest with Candy Mossett, a Native Energy and Climate Campaign organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network in North Dakota, and Stephanie Sosi, associate attorney with Earth Justice and a co-counsel representing the tribe in its lawsuit against the Army Corps of Engineers over the Dakota Access Pipeline. And if you have any questions for Candy or Stephanie about what is happening there, we'd love to hear from you. So many people have been following this. If you have any questions about context, I just got back last night, and just seeing the land and seeing the Missouri River and interviewing people about the larger issues just gives you so much more context about what this is all about. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Stephanie, can you tell us more about this ruling? Why did the court make this decision? Why did the court reject the tribe's request for an injunction?
Well, in the order that we have, you know, unfortunately, it's a little sparse on the legal reasoning. But to get an injunction, it's pretty standard across jurisdictions. You have to meet four factors, and they just said we didn't meet them. You know, it's a pretty extraordinary form of relief, and we were, you know, making the argument that the tribe is entitled to this, but the court just didn't see it that way.
So we just don't really have much information to explain why?
No. Unfortunately, it's just an order that's denying our injunction pending appeal. The appeal process will go forward. So when that goes forward, we can talk about the merits, which is where we'll learn a little bit more about why the court is making the decisions that they do.
Okay, so can you elaborate on that? What does that mean exactly? What happens with the appeals process?
Sure. So the D.C. Circuit, the order yesterday was in response to a request that we made, and we asked the court to just put a pause on construction while we work through the appeal. And that's what the court denied. So they are, you know, they're having us go through the appeal. And in that process, what we're doing is we're looking at the district court's decision, and we're appealing the district court's decision. And we'll go through our claims again, you know, arguing the law, why the law says that Section 106 applies, and then also, you know, how DAPL and the Corps did not come with the law, and that will go forward. You know, even though the order yesterday came out denying the injunction, the appeal will go forward.
And so then what does it mean when we got word yesterday that the Army Corps of Engineers will not yet authorize construction? What does that mean?
So right now, the only part of the pipeline that Dakota Access does not have authorization to construct is underneath the Missouri River. So they need an easement. They need it's permission from the Corps to construct underneath the Missouri River. Unfortunately, they've already received all of the other permits that they need from the Corps. And so when the Corps says that they won't authorize construction, they're referencing the land that they own around the river. They're not going to authorize construction then, and that they have not yet issued the easement to drill under the river.
And that is Stephanie Soce, an associate attorney with Earth Justice. Candy Mossett is a Native Energy and Climate Campaign organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network in North Dakota. And we're getting an update on the Dakota Access Pipeline and efforts to stop it. Candy, I wanted to ask you what water protectors are dealing with on a regular basis. I mean, a lot of people there say, we're not protesters, we are water protectors. When I was there over the past couple of days, there was almost constantly a helicopter flying overhead. And the ACLU of Wyoming, Sabrina King and Will Munger, a water protector, wrote a really interesting story about surveillance and militarization and what people are dealing with. They point out that in mid-August, the governor of North Dakota declared a state of emergency. Despite the governor and local sheriff's verbal commitment to allowing protected lawful protest, the state of emergency has resulted in a suppression of the right to protest. They point out that surveillance starts early in the morning with near constant low overflights of the camp by planes and helicopters. One morning on October 2nd, flights were recorded at 7:15, 7:45, and 11:25. Water protectors are followed on county roads by state and private security helicopters as they drive on public roads in Morton County. Can you tell us what else has been happening and what's been the response to this? I mean, the people are taking photos of the helicopters. They say they're trying to get numbers to find out where they're coming from.
Right. So first, I just want to let everybody that's listening know that they should go to earthjustice.org and they can look at the frequently asked questions section, because there you can actually see the Court of Appeals decision from the three-panel judge, and you can read for yourself exactly what the language was and what the four determinations were that supposedly the tribe is not providing to those judges. Those judges are Brown, Griffith, and Pillard, by the way. So those are the circuit judges that made that decision. So I just encourage everybody to go to Earth Justice website and look at the frequently asked questions so they can read that themselves, as well as the statement from the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, David Archambault, in response to the decision. And then I can tell you from my own personal experiences what I have been dealing with. I am here in camp with my 3-year-old daughter. I've been here since August 15th. And I've been getting used to waking up in the morning to the sound of the helicopter flying overhead. But lately it seems like they've been flying lower and lower. I don't even know how legal that is for them to fly as close as they have been flying to the camp. When we're on Media Hill, the chopper feels like it's literally right above us, to the point where we can feel the wind from the blades when we're standing up on Media Hill, and that's how close it is. There's also been an issue with a helicopter that appears to be the same helicopter switching out their tail numbers, because we've been writing down the numbers on the tail of the helicopter. There has been at least three that we've seen, and we saw one that had blue pinstripes one day and yellow pinstripes the next day, but the same tail number. So that was really confusing to us. We had found out from a press release that the FAA was saying that they were breaking the rule and regulation through the FAA as well. So it's hard to get information. It's hard to really fully understand everything that's happening out in the outside world, because we're so isolated. We're not in an area that has good Wi-Fi or cell phone access. But I myself have been in situations where I've been on a county road and I've been followed by a U.S. government vehicle, not necessarily a police vehicle, but the plate with the U.S. government. I have been that feeling of being followed whenever I'm in the Bismarck area. I don't know if I'm intentionally being followed or if there's just so many police that I'm not sure. But I know that my little car that I'm in is constantly going back and forth, giving people rides to and from the airport that come in from all over the world, just making supply runs and things like that. So I do know that they know my information, but I can tell you from firsthand experiences that, yes, we are being followed. And, yes, the helicopters are flying every day. And, yes, they are ramping up with more and more and more police coming in every day, now from different states. We've already identified Fargo police and Grand Forks police and all the different counties that are here besides Morton County. But now we're starting to see, like, Wyoming or Wisconsin. It was one of those states where there's different police force coming in. And it's really ridiculous that taxpayers are being forced to spend money to have police that stand around, and they're so gung-ho for something to happen that on Sunday we had a march. There was a tribe that came in, and they did a really small march from the camp, the Ocheti Shekowin camp off of 1806, up to the first barricade site. When that happened, the police mobilized. 15 units showed up at our frontline camp. Two of the larger militarized-style vehicles showed up, and so we got a call, like, hey, the cops are coming to the front lines. We don't know what's going on. I believe it was all a result of us doing, of a tribe that came in, doing a peaceful march, walking from point A to point B, and the cops quickly mobilized because they're so eager for something to happen. They're just all standing around waiting for something to happen, and it's scary because when that tension continues to build in a police, a militarized police, all it takes is one police officer that's trigger happy to cause an accident, and that's what we're scared of. We're like living in fear as protectors, but we're also continuing to say that we will put our bodies on the line to stop the pipeline. So it's stressful. It's scary. But to that, there's the opposite side, which is the beauty of it. There's the singing and the dancing and the visiting with each other and talking to nations that are coming in from all over the place. And so there's a big difference between being in the camp where it's a safe zone. Well, it feels like more of a safe zone than on the front lines, which mostly is what the media captures. All on the front lines is a bit further north of where the camp is, where they're actually building the pipeline. So it's like people that make the decision to go to the front lines know fully that we're probably going to be met with militarized opposition. That has always been the case, but now we're starting to see a little bit of not feeling as safe in the camps. There's been police driving back and forth on Highway 1806 taking pictures of the camp. There's been observations of police without jurisdiction actually being on the reservation. There's a video on Facebook that shows how one of the tribal councilmen approached a state vehicle and said, you don't have any jurisdiction to be here. He was parked near Cannonball, North Dakota, and he said, oh, we didn't know we were on the reservation. And it's clearly marked that you're entering standing. You have to go across Cannonball River. Like, you clearly know when you're on the reservation. And there were police that had no jurisdiction or no business being there that had to be basically run out and say, no, you cannot legally be here. You have no jurisdiction on the reservation. So they are watching people drive back and forth from the casino to the camp. They are continuing to ramp up their efforts, and it's causing, I think, unnecessary tension. And the militarization has to stop because the police should be in their own communities, in their, where they're needed to deal with their real crimes or violence or whatever they need to be dealing with in their communities is where they need to be. They don't need to be here militarized against water protectors who have remained peaceful and who have remained nonviolent literally now for months. We have done nothing to show aggression. We are unarmed. We are with our women, our children, our men, and we have done nothing but pray and smudge and stand in ceremony. We erected a teepee, and we've been attacked. We've been attacked by private security that DAPL has hired. We've been sprayed in the face with tear gas. We've been bitten by dogs. We have met violence, and yet we remain 100% peaceful. So the police do not need to be here.
That is Candy Mossett, a Native Energy and Climate Campaign Organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network in North Dakota. Candy and her three-year-old daughter have been at the camp in North Dakota since August 15th. We're also joined today by Stephanie Soce, an associate attorney with Earth Justice and co-counsel representing the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in its lawsuit against the Army Corps of Engineers over the Dakota Access Pipeline. On today's Your Call, we are talking about the pipeline and the ongoing movement to stop the pipeline, and then the larger movement for tribal sovereignty, the right to live on the land, and finding solutions to our environmental crisis. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. Today we are talking about what is happening with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's effort to stop construction of the pipeline by Texas-based Energy Transfer Partners. On Sunday, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia rejected this request. And then yesterday, on Indigenous Peoples Day, more than 200 people protested at two sites to stop construction. 29 people were arrested. There's different numbers out there. 27 or 29 people were arrested. And we're getting the latest from Candy Mossett, a Native Energy and Climate Campaign Organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network in North Dakota. She's been at the camp since August 15th. Stephanie Soce is an associate attorney with Earth Justice and co-counsel representing the tribe in its lawsuit against the Army Corps of Engineers over the Dakota Access Pipeline. And let's hear from Kathy in San Francisco. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, Rose. I love your show, as always. I'm grateful you've gone there. My question is, I heard that the pipeline company, bought property on Cannonball Ranch, and I wonder now how that's impacted everything, because now they own private property and that takes rights over everything.
Okay, can you elaborate on that? What did you hear?
There were some people that owned Cannonball Ranch, and it was right near where the Native American people are, and they sold a huge part of the ranch to the sold the ranch to the pipeline company. And I just wondered how that impacted everything, because now they own more of the land.
All right. Candy, do you know anything about this?
Yes. David and Brenda Meyer own Cannonball Ranch, and it was sold by them on September 22nd. They cited liability reasons. David Meyer told, I think it was Indian Country Today, that it's a beautiful ranch, but I just want it out. That was quote-unquote from him. And so Dakota Access bought this ranch. I believe it was like, I want to say 6,000 acres that they bought. It is not currently where the camp is located. Where the camp is located, we are on Army Corps of Engineers land, actually, where the camp is located. But the Cannonball Ranch has been sold to Dakota Access, although my understanding is that they had 30 days from that date of sale to explain to the North Dakota, I'm trying to look it up right now, there's a farming law that protects farmers in North Dakota from industry, and it may have been a sale that shouldn't have taken place. They're supposed to let the state of North Dakota know exactly what their intentions are for buying Cannonball Ranch, because this law protects basically ranchers from being bought out by industry to do these types of projects. They're supposed to be protected. I do know that the landowner was being bullied. The landowner was being harassed. There was potential lawsuits against the landowner. I feel like they were probably bullied into selling that ranch. But it's something where Standing Rock had actually been hoping to buy that ranch previously in years prior, but couldn't afford it. And so it was just a really interesting and complicated decision of how Dakota Access Energy Transfer Partners came about being able to buy that from those landowners and what they must have done to get them to sell it to them.
Hmm. Well, thank you for the phone call. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have any questions about the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline, which would go under the Missouri River, and the tribe says that it would affect people who get their drinking water from the Missouri River. If there's one rupture, it would be devastating for 18 million people. And again, I think this is such an important fact. The original pipeline was supposed to cross the Missouri River just north of Bismarck, which is the capital of North Dakota. But after there were concerns about the city's water supply, the route was then shifted downstream to the tribe's doorstep. And so that is just one of many reasons why so many people have gathered at this main camp. There are about 2,000 people. Candy, I heard there were about 5,000 at its height. Is that about right? I mean, obviously, it's so hard to have an accurate count of everyone at the camp.
Mm-hmm. That's about, I'd say 5,000 to 6,000, especially over Labor Day weekend. We had just crazy numbers, and usually on the weekends it does swell. I'd say at any given time we have probably around 1,200 that have been staying in the Sacred Stone and the Chetishikowin camps, which are right across the Cannonball River from each other. Chetishikowin came about as sort of an overflow camp just off of 1806, because when all these people came in August, there was not enough room at the Sacred Stone camp. And so when people come, they've been getting confused, like, where am I going? Where am I standing right now? So technically there are two camps that are the same camp, but we're divided by the Cannonball River.
Right. And so over 300 tribal nations have come to express solidarity. And you mentioned the action that happened on Sunday when a tribe arrives, they're greeted in ceremony. Sometimes they sing, sometimes they dance. You were talking about the tribe that decided to march to the front line, which is about 2 miles from the camp. Was that mm-hmm. the Comanche tribe?
Yeah, I posted. It's so funny. We rely on social media out here quite a bit, and so I put it on my Facebook page so that people could see, but hopefully not get confused by that peaceful action had happened on Sunday.
Right.
And so when that tribe, when they came in, they had decided, you know, this is the way we're going to come in, because people have been organizing a walk on the road into the camp. And so they had organized a walk from the camp up the road to the first site. Like you said, it's about a mile or maybe a little over a mile up the road. And so when that happened, the helicopters started flying. Mm. We were like, something must be going on. Something's got to be happening. Pretty soon we heard, get to the front lines, get to the front lines. The cops are coming. And we were like, okay, what's going on? What's happening? And so the Comanche were just walking. The Comanche tribe of maybe 30 people, maybe, that were walking and were just going to be welcomed into the camp and walk up to that first barricade site. And 15 police cruisers showed up, like we said, and we saw through our own eye in the sky that they were just in a marina just north of the frontline camp, and there was all kinds of cops. There was two big militarized police vehicles just ready to go as a result of that Comanche tribe holding their flag. It's a Comanche's on the move, and they were holding their flags, and they were just praying and walking up to a site, and that's what happened.
And I heard a few of the tribal members speak when they got back to the main camp, and they were crying, basically saying, we came here in peace. This is mm-hmm. not something we expected.
None of us expected that, but like I said before, when police are militarized, when more and more and more police are called in, taken away from their own communities, and are told that they're up against violent rioters, they expect something to happen. They expect to be put to work. They are just waiting for something to happen. It's like they are creating the fear, and they are creating the unnecessary tensions. And our governor, Jack Dalrymple, needs to remove the state of emergency that he declared. He needs to stop the militarization of the police and recognize that what is being done to us as Native Americans is a complete and unfair treatment of water protectors who are simply defending our right to have peaceful gatherings against a company destroying sacred sites and destroying waterways. It's never been done to any other sector in the country. I mean, I guess I shouldn't say never. What we're seeing that's happening to us as Natives in North Dakota is pretty unprecedented. I'm not going to say it was never done, but it just goes to show that the treatment of Native Americans in this country has always been unfair, and it is now being brought to light and to national public attention more and more. It's not being able to easily be held back anymore.
Right.
The way that we're misfairly treated in this country, still in this day and age, in 2016, when we do a peaceful protest and our protection actions, when we get together to defend water rights for over 18 million people, we're met with militarization and equipment that's used for times of war. The equipment that we have seen facing us when we go to a place has been military equipment that apparently is used in war, times of war. And so it's crazy. It's crazy to be able to drive down a public highway expecting to go see a site, to pray at a site, and that public highway is blocked by the police. The police are here protecting Energy Transfer Partners because they're not allowing us to go to the public roads, to the county roads that are public access roads. They're telling us that we're against our legal rights by doing that, and it's just not true. We're within our legal rights to be on these roads.
And Stephanie, can you talk about the legalities behind this? The legal team at the camp said that obviously there's a pretty hard crackdown. Some of the people who've already been arrested, not talking about the people yesterday, but the 90 people who've been arrested, some of them have to go to trial just 2 days before Christmas. And the legal team says that they're obviously trying to send a very strong message by doing this.
Yeah. Well, there are two legal teams that are supporting the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. There's the legal team that Candy's referring to on the ground in North Dakota, part of the camp. And then I'm part of the legal team that's challenging the core in D.C. And, you know, for jurisdictional reasons and because we're not criminal attorneys, we are incredibly separate. So, unfortunately, I can't talk about anything that's happening on the camp.
We have an email from Marcy who says the intense militarization that Candy is describing is very troubling. How can those of us who are not on site help protect the protectors? I think of the old slogan, "The whole world is watching." Will it help for us to diffuse the news over our social media networks? Are there authorities we should contact? And she says, with deep gratitude for the water protectors. Candy, how can people help?
I think people can contact and continue to contact the Morton County Sheriff's Department, Morton County, M-O-R-T-O-N, because they are the lead county on all of this activity. They can definitely contact Governor Jack Dalrymple and tell the governor of North Dakota that he is wrong in allowing this to continue. In fact, Governor Jack Dalrymple and the state of North Dakota have asked the federal government for $6 million to continue the effort. And they were denied that request, and now they're using taxpayers' money, and they're blaming us, the water protectors, for them not getting their money and for them needing money. They're blaming us for continuing to call in more and more police officers. And so we need to call out these people that are here in North Dakota, Senator Heidi Heitkamp, Senator John Hoeven. They all need to be getting phone calls. They need to be getting letters. The world needs to see that what's happening to us on the ground here is not something that this country is supposedly founded on when it comes to democracy, freedom of speech, all of our amendment rights. As Native Americans, we know all too well the history that this country was founded upon. Mm. From day one, we have been treated negatively, and we need people to stand with us and to fight back against those that are in positions of power, the Morton County Sheriff's Department, the Governor Jack Dalrymple, the Senators John Hoeven and Heidi Heitkamp. We're in a fossil fuel state. This state has known fossil fuels, has been getting money from fossil fuels for years, for decades and decades and decades, and it is very hard for them to shift away from a fossil fuel economy into a wind or sun or solar economy, which it shouldn't be, because North Dakota is one of the windiest states in this entire country. You know, we have alternatives. We do have them. We're not saying just stop the pipeline. We're saying subsidize the renewable energy companies here. But no, it's oil and gas that's clearly subsidized here. We need to subsidize our wind. We need to subsidize our solar. We need to look into the possibility of alternative hemp solutions. I mean, people are so scared of hemp, it's ridiculous. And in my master's degree program, I did a life cycle analysis of organic cotton versus hemp and proved the over 25,000 uses of hemp to be able to provide clothing and oils and food and other needs. And I'm telling you right now, for those of you that don't understand, you could smoke an entire field of hemp and never so much as get a buzz. You'll end up with just a headache. It is not directly connected to marijuana at all. It's a weed that grows, that produces 9 times more fiber than cotton and uses 9 times less water than cotton, that we should be looking at given the global climate chaos that we are now in as human beings. There is no debate around climate change. There is no debate that the temperatures are rising. And yet, Dakota Access Energy Transfer Partners wants to build a pipeline that per year will contribute to the equivalent of 29.5 new coal-fired power plants being put in this country. That's per year. Another way to look at that, that's 21.4 million new vehicles on the road. That's the equivalent of carbon emissions that this pipeline will be emitting into the atmosphere per year. So if the United States, President Obama, if we as a country are serious about reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, this pipeline and others like it would not be allowed to be built.
Well, let's take two calls back to back, and then we'll get responses from our guests, Candy Mossett with the Indigenous Environmental Network and Stephanie Sosi with Earth Justice. Let's go to Stephen in San Francisco. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Rose. I'm just wondering if the ACLU or Earth Justice or the United Nations are not picking up on a legal challenge here, which basically is environmental racism. Based upon what you're saying, they're moving the pipeline from Bismarck, which is an urban white setting, to an indigenous rural setting. So this sounds like environmental racism to me.
Mm. Well, thank you, Stephen. In fact, I met Jermaine Tremel at the camp. She is the great-great-great-granddaughter of Sitting Bull. She said for various reasons, up until now, because of this movement, they are now speaking out and saying that they are descendants of Sitting Bull. And she is an attorney with the UN, and they are getting ready to work on a genocide case and submit it to the international court about the because of exactly what you talked about. She's going to be coming through the Bay Area in the coming months, and we're definitely going to get her on the show. So that's coming, and then I'll ask Stephanie to comment on that in just a few minutes. First, let's go to George in San Francisco. Hi, George. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. When you consider legal actions, can you tell us what's the next, if there is one, step that we could support in the way of legal process?
All right. Thank you. So, Stephanie, what about Stephen's first comment about, you know, filing a suit over environmental racism because the pipeline was moved from just north of Bismarck, the capital of North Dakota, to basically the tribe's doorstep?
Yes, no, absolutely. There's definitely environmental racism, environmental justice concerns there. You know, the tribe has a drinking water intake a few miles down from where the pipeline crossing is, and that's a claim, you know, to flesh out. So I can't... since we're currently in litigation, that is something that we could look under the NEPA claim of our complaint, but I can't really speak for a number of reasons.
Okay.
But I will make a well, first I'll thank Candy for mentioning our website. We do update that website as soon as something happens. So as soon as we get a court order or as soon as we make a filing, we try and update that website immediately because we know how important this fight is to so many people. And in terms of the next legal steps, I want to circle back to something I said earlier, which is that the Army Corps still has not issued the easement under the Missouri River. So it is certainly worth pressing the Army Corps, pressing the Obama administration to keep the Army Corps from issuing that easement. You know, they have the power to deny that easement and until they can comply with Section 106. And also, you know, the administration also has the power to require Dakota Access and the Army Corps to do a full EIS. So if, you know, to echo Candy's call to action on the state level, on the federal level, these are things that people could do now. because that easement has not yet been issued. So the tribe is hopeful that with those efforts, the administration will do the right thing and deny the easement and, you know, actually do the right thing by the people of the Standing Rock tribe and all of the people who rely on the Missouri River for drinking water.
And Candy, we only have about 30 seconds left, but what happens from here? I mean, when I was there, it was about 40 degrees, 35 degrees, which is very cold for someone coming from California, very, very windy. The plan is to winterize the camp and possibly stay through the winter. Is that right?
We are staying through the winter. Not possibly.
Okay, you are staying through the winter.
And we are looking at building permanent structures. We have earth lodges, longhouses, winterized teepees, potentially straw bale buildings. Even yurts and tiny houses are on the docket for what's being potentially coming to the camp. So those of you that can't make it, please continue to donate at sacredstonecamp.org, indigenousrising.org, visit our Facebook pages, and support us in any way you can, because we're going to be here as long as this company is here. When people ask me, how long are you going to be there, what my response is, as long as it takes.
Candy Mossett is a Native Energy and Climate Campaign Organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network in North Dakota. Stephanie Sosi is Associate Attorney with Earth Justice. Stephanie and Candy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Matsigirad.
Thank you. And in the coming days, be sure to check KALW's Facebook page. I'll be posting photos of people who are at the camp, including Jermaine Tremel, the great-great-great-granddaughter of Sitting Bull, along with so many other people who grew up with the American Indian Movement right in the middle of it. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with three of this year's Broward Youth Award winners. Every year, the award honors young leaders for their accomplishments in the environmental movement, from taxing oil and gas companies to turning recycled plastic into material for 3D printing. These young people are combining technology with urgent solutions to our environmental crisis. What can we learn from them? Tweet your questions and comments to @YourCallRadio and join us live at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.